welcome back to Grow Sessions. I'm your host, Tony Pavlakis, and today we're going to talk to our special guest, Mark Pesakovich, on our latest episode entitled Shedding Light on the Cannabis Industry.
Hello again, and welcome back to Grow Sessions. I'm your host, Tony Pavlakis, and today we're talking with my good friend, Mark Pesakovich. He's from Illinois. He's a specialty is a leadership development, training, public speaking, diversity and inclusion in public relations, political consulting, project management, nonprofit consulting, and a writer. And he is also a lobbyist. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks a lot. As you can tell, I'm actually having a hard time getting my hat straight. So,
oh, no worries.
My level of competence is, questionable.
It happens. So looking at your bio, you look like you're not that busy at all. You know, there's nothing on your list of things to do. But as we were chatting before we talked, I'm just curious, you know, like some of the things that we talked about earlier, like can we kind of dive deep into some of these topics? Like you said, you know, you're a lobbyist for the cannabis councils in Illinois. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, so, and it's actually together and separate as a matter. My profession, first and foremost, is lobbying on behalf of a wide variety of clients, anything from construction to mental health to cannabis.
Okay.
And I work on a variety of issues, primarily at the state level. So I spend a lot of time talking to state legislators, state representatives, state senators, you know, the governor's office, et cetera, et cetera. And in that capacity, I have been very involved since the early part of the cannabis industry in Illinois, because a friend and a mentor of mine applied for and won medical licenses in Illinois back in the day.
Yep.
And I worked with them ever since. And so worked on a number of key issues, including making cannabis an option for people instead of opioids.
That's huge. That is absolutely huge.
That's sort of, I classify under sort of doing the Lord's work. You don't get a lot of satisfaction like that as a lobbyist.
But that's, I mean, it's funny. I don't want to cut you off, but it's just funny that I was talking with my wife, and I'm going into like different cultivation facilities, and sometimes they're tied to the retail store. And I go during the day, obviously, I'm not going at night. And the people that are in the stores during the day are mostly older people going for medicine. You know, that's, you know, everybody has this misconception that I'm sure there's a portion of it that people are going for the recreational part. But during the day, you see these people, and it's all these folks that, you know, I would say like my parents' generation, they're in there, they have aches, pains, they're talking to these bud tenders and people in the retail store, and they're asking, you know, this is what hurts, or this is what I'm having. And they're saying, well, they're recommending different forms of medicine. And it's kind of eye-opening, because people don't understand. I think there's a big misconception in this society.
So to that point, first of all, that's the fastest growing segment of the cannabis consumer market is senior citizens. And second of all, one of the things to keep in mind also is that the younger you are, the more likely you are to have had a guy before cannabis ever became legal, right?
Oh, and so, for sure, everybody's got a guy.
And so the senior citizens who are actually using, or others who are using it now that it is a legal alternative that is labeled and regulated and tested, are the main ones who are going, as you said, to the dispensaries and getting this stuff, because for them, this is a new option that they're excited about, rather than, you know, calling up their guy. And so within that context, that's huge. And so just so you understand that, so that's what a lobbyist does. And to give you an anecdote about that, when we were working on that law, it seemed like a no-brainer. I was working with a guy who was a, you know, retired colonel in the state police who had been opposed to this law, and he finally met enough people who came up to him and said, oh my God, this has changed my life. I've gotten, you know, I used to be on 8 pills and now I'm on 3.
Yeah, see, that's big.
And he changed his mind, and a lot of us saw that. And then we dealt with a governor at that time, Bruce Rauner, who didn't like the word pain. He thought that the word pain...
Like in pain management, you mean? Like, or something, or pain care?
He didn't want people to qualify for cannabis for pain.
Okay.
He did not want pain to be an eligible condition, like multiple sclerosis. And he felt that way because he thought that pain was sort of a weasel way to get any hippie wanting to get high in, you know, on their nose under the tent, because it's so hard to tell what pain is, right?
And so, yeah, exactly.
And so that was his objection. And so we had to write the legislation and move it to the legislature. And obviously I played only one small part, but the whole bill was worded to avoid the word pain, even though that's what we were after. And so that's why we had a piece of legislation that ultimately allowed, made patients who were eligible for opioids, made them eligible for cannabis as an option.
That's awesome. You know, when you hear these stories, like how things start to come about, it really, it just makes me so much even more passionate about the industry that we're really helping. And it is going to be the, I mean, I've said it before, and like I talk with my wife about this, who, you know, she's never ever used cannabis in her life. And we talk about it will be the medicine of the future, and it's becoming the medicine of the future. And it's going to be, as the testing and more funding comes into it, it's just, they're going to find so many great things from this plant that is all natural.
Absolutely. And it's not only cannabis, it's also psilocybin starting to really hit it big.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And you know, that's going to be sort of indoor agriculture as well.
Yeah.
So of interest to both of us. The point is, you know, the way I like to tell people about it is that medicine used to come for plants for hundreds of thousands of years, right? Finally, man became so smart that we thought we could take what we've learned in nature and make it better. Synthetics. And finally, we've gotten our comeuppance, and we're coming back to the perspective that maybe what nature gave us is the better option to begin with. So it's like,
I agree.
You know, and so it's not at all strange to view any plant as a medicine, because that's natural compounds is what most synthetic medical compounds and discoveries are based on.
Yeah.
You know, we look at an animal that's able to maintain, you know, thin blood or high oxygenation in a certain environment, and we produce something that helps people whose heart has problems pumping carry more oxygen in their blood. That's where it comes from. And so that's what we're doing, you know, that's what you and I are part of sort of bringing back to the fore, is the way I see it.
We're bringing back the old school.
Yeah. Yeah, look at our hats. You know, how old school can you get?
Right? I'm telling you what. Look at us. We're thinking we're cool cats over here.
That's right. That's right.
well, Mark, there's we can always chat about so many things. But I know that before, when we were chatting, we were talking about some of the challenges in like the cannabis industry right now. What do you see, like, when someone comes to you and says, "I want to get into the cannabis industry"? What do you see the biggest challenges being? I loved your answer before. Let's see if you'll give it to me again.
I don't remember. So
I'll refresh your memory. What you said before is like, when, you know, I asked you what your challenges were, and you said, if I wanted to get into cannabis, you go, you should have come and talked to me 2 years ago.
Well,
which is kind of true.
That's true. But look, I'm not only cannabis, lobbyist, I'm also a cannabis consumer, so you can't blame me for not remembering.
That's all good.
The reality is that in at least in Illinois, applications were due, you know, in 2019, and we're still waiting on that route of licenses.
Really?
Has screwed it up so badly. Our first round of adult use dispensary licenses will be 1 year late, May 1.
1 year late this May.
Correct.
So when they went to go apply, they applied in 2018?
Well, 20, 2019 okay. for licenses in 2020.
Okay, and then they ran a year late, and now they get in right. 2021.
So that's dispensaries. Okay.
Okay. What then, about cultivation?
The cultivation, or what, craft grow, infusion, and transport, which are the three classes of licenses in Illinois.
Okay.
Will be a year late on July 1.
It just, you got to love the state system sometimes.
Well, you know, and I again, as a lobbyist, I always try to tell clients, you know, sort of, if a state wants a horse, they're going to start with a monkey and a tiger and be delighted if they finish up with a four-hoofed animal like a cow.
Oh my God, that's great. Okay. Well, it's just the process. Everywhere you see it.
And that cow is going to be damn close enough for a horse for the state government. And
oh my God.
That's just the way it works.
Well, it's like that everywhere. Like, we go to a lot of different states with what we do, and we are in many states. And, you know, we have fixtures in our lighting as a platform everywhere. But like, when you talk to people, everybody has a different story of how, what happened. You know, they're like, oh, well, I had to wait for this. Or when you and I were chatting, and I talk with people, and or they call us for the first time, and they're like, yo, I've got a friend in government. I should be able to get this license in 4 months. And I'm like,
yeah.
It's a little bit more than that. And I appreciate their ambition, but it does take a little bit. Be prepared for the long haul, because it's nothing that, like, you go down and fill out one form and then you're good. It's not like that at all. I mean, there's background checks, and then there's the waiting, and then there's in mass, I want to say there's, you know, submitted app stage, then there's provisional stage where you can actually start building but you can't be growing, and then you have to get an approval from them, and that doesn't even include all the local in town licensing and building permits and making sure you're within fire codes, within your door, like everything. So there's a ton of other inspections that go along with it, and then they commence operations where, yes, you can start growing, but we're not going to give you a final license until after you've run a few cycles. So you're still on like a probationary period. Do you find that like that in Illinois as well? There's like all these different, I'm going to call them stages, but I don't know if that's the right word.
Tony, we're way much more advanced. It's sort of, what is that quote I love from Caddyshack? Don't sell yourself short, judge, you're a tremendous slouch. So here in Illinois, yes, we've had all that, and you're right. And of course, as I mentioned, we had applications, and we had license scoring, and we even had dispensaries an announcement of scores.
Interesting.
And then we had disclosures that the scoring was completely screwed up, and that a company that was hired with a last minute multi-million dollar contract to do the scoring, like, didn't do the math right in certain situations. So it wasn't like a policy issue, right? It was just, yep, we can't add. And then the other part of it was that, well, we asked questions and we got answers back, but we didn't record that we got the answers. And then another part of it was, oh, look, lo and behold, partner in the Chicago office of that company was one of the winning applicants in the application process. The company that he's an investor in was.
That's interesting.
That's like so stupid that nobody would almost do that on purpose. Like, you know what I mean? Nobody would be so brazen as to say, I work for KPMG and I'm also going to apply for a pot license while KPMG scoring licenses. But the ultimate outcome, even though it's much more likely to be stupidity than malice, in my charitable estimation. That's the case. So, so you've had the application stage, but in more and more states, Florida, New Jersey, Illinois, you then have to plan your runway long enough for a good year or two of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then in Illinois, after this has been a year late and there's litigation, they are now, I'm working on legislation that they're, you know, that has been proposed this year that would essentially change the rules of the game for applications that have already been submitted and scored.
So they have to redo it now or no?
Well, not only do they have to redo it, they're saying you had three options to apply for social equity. Now you're going to have two options. Everybody who chose a third option no longer gets to play.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Okay.
Like now, there's again,
there's the question of the merit of the actual policy issue here, and I get that.
Sure.
But the stupidity is that if you change the rules after the game, you're inviting a million more lawsuits.
Yeah, and like, and do they have the bandwidth to manage that either? Like, you can't.
Well, it's not even to manage that. Here's the point. The through all this, we want to help quote unquote true social equity applicants.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. In my estimation, true social equity applicants are almost by definition is intended to be the most low resourced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't have the funds. They're not the big MSOs.
The funds of sophistication, the funds to hire somebody like me.
Yeah.
To pay somebody like you.
Yeah.
And so the people who have the money can wait out the lawsuits. They're still eating.
And they're traditionally there. I mean, not saying that people aren't working, but you know, they're like the smartest growers that like I see. Like I talk to all ranges. You know, I talk to, there's the dreamer people, which I can appreciate it, but they're still going to be far off and they don't have funds or they don't have a host community agreement. And then there's, you know, there's the middle of the range people that have got it kind of together and they've grown a little bit or they've worked for somebody and they're kind of getting out there and that's, they're getting a taste. And then there's the, might even be like four classes of people, I guess we'll say, or clients, you know, then there's the people that are growing and they, or they have another business and another, and I don't want to call it a side gig, but you know, guy owns a construction company or there's a realtor. So they're hustling and they're making money still. And then this is their, hey, you know, I would like to get into cannabis. Let's put everything in play, but we're still going to need to do, you know, we're going to have to be a little bit lean. And then there's the big MSOs that are just, you know, they've got tons of dough and they still try to do things on the shy sometimes on certain aspects of it, because now it's a numbers crunching thing. But so, like you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you finish.
No, I was saying, so I met someone just the other day. So he's got, you know, a grow here local and he's building a couple of dispensaries and he's got one investor, one partner, and then he's building two more cultivation facilities in different states. But, you know, however they have to work it with all the different corporations, but they're just smart that, okay, he's growing. He's just going to replicate what he's doing in another location and he's going to, you know, go through all the loopholes and jump hole, but he's got businesses already running. So he's not just waiting. He's actually, I'm just gonna keep on working and let stuff play out, you know, kind of just, you almost have to do that. You can't just sit there and be like, well, I should have it on the 30th of April. I mean, you know, don't wait, just keep on doing your thing. And then when it happens and be ready to go.
Right. And here in Illinois, as part of, let's say your craft grow license application, you have to have the facility where you're going to be located as part of the application.
So yeah, I think that's how, like here too, like in most of the New England states.
So the point is that you have to have control of the facility throughout the application process.
So you have to be paying rent.
Well, or paying an LOI or something, right? Nobody's going to hold their property indefinitely for you for free.
No.
So you either buy it and mortgage it, you are paying to hold it. So you, because right. So I know an applicant in Illinois who they lost their property. They couldn't hold it anymore because the state's a year late. And I don't, you would know better than I would, because I'm not really a numbers guy. I mean, tell me. So usually when it's craft grow, that's let's say 15,000 square feet canopy, I say usually your facility should be at least three times.
I mean, it's between two and three times the size of your canopy, because you're going to need, between hallways and egress and then all the production that goes into it. I mean, there, you have to have offices, you have to have lockers, you have to have break rooms. There is obviously restrooms and there's drying, there's curing, there's propagate. I mean, there's so many rooms that go into it other than just canopy of flower. And
not to mention the part, you know, the only part in the process that can actually go boom, the extraction, which
yes, if they are doing an extraction facility.
Well, that's the great thing. Like, you know, at least in Illinois, the cultivator can do everything. They can grow, extract, infuse. Whereas an infuser can just infuse.
Yeah.
And a transporter can just transport. The cultivator can also process, et cetera, et cetera. So that those are the only ones that are going to have extraction facilities in addition to the large current cultivators. So the point being, you know, if you are doing something for, if you approach anyone who owns real estate and tell them that you want it for cannabis use, and they know that it's suitable for cannabis use, and that the zoning looks likely, and you're in a friendly community,
yeah,
and you have a facility where they can get good electricity, water, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to charge them four times what you would charge a machine shop.
They get the cannabis bump. You get the cannabis bump in some of these buildings.
Right. So then you have to either buy or hold the facility beginning with your application process. So now you're a year late.
Oh my God.
How much is a 45,000 square foot facility
holy crap.
A cannabis friendly municipality worth?
Yeah, exactly. So there's some funds that are being expelled that some of these people, like, they're for the lack of better words, they're going broke before they even started.
Right.
You know, they haven't had a chance to plant anything, and they're already going broke because it's that waiting part.
Right. And so this is sort of what you and I have been talking about, are the kinds of considerations that I
what do you see as like a solution for that though? Like, is it just the process is just so convoluted, or is it just they don't know, so we're kind of writing the process as we go? I kind of feel like that a little bit too when I talk with folks in this market, that there's so many unknowns that these commissions, we'll call them, I don't know what they call them in Illinois, but I know like in here that like there's different, you know, there's office of, you know, commission or this to commission or the cannabis control commission, I think they're learning as they go. So they're writing the rule book. We're writing the rule book as we're moving forward. I mean, there are some kind of guidelines, but they don't really, things are changing. It's just a moving target because no one knows.
Well, that's true. And you can improve your chances in getting an application or in writing an application or in lobbying on subsequently on the law if you hire an expert. You know, in some ways,
for sure.
Great plug for me, but the reality is, it's like I tell people, you know, like let's say you, right? I mean, in some ways, I'm very similar to you. One of, you know, like sort of roughly categorize you in one of the areas, lighting, right?
Then
one of the things that you and I have in common is we both shed light on things.
Yes, very true. That is really good.
Okay, so a lot of people don't understand what they don't understand in Illinois. Right now it's very popular. So you have three ways you can qualify for social equity. To get it back to my, you know, subject that I'm beating to death at my work right now.
It's all right.
One way to qualify for social equity is to do it through a minor cannabis crime conviction or arrest for the person or their immediate family.
Okay.
If it's a crime expungible under this new law, which, you know, you get busted for a joint.
Yeah.
You don't want to, you know, in the past, it has ruined your life, particularly.
If
black or brown. So that's one way to qualify. Another way to qualify is to have lived a substantial part of your life in a over-policed, sort of vulnerable, community. So there are, you know, distressed communities in Illinois, you know, there's a website.
Yeah, there's a lot of
state
lot
has. Of... Right. So another way is to have lived 5 out of the last 10 years in a designated community.
Okay.
And essentially a third way is through, at the time of application, having at least 10 full-time employees.
Okay.
And having at least 51% of them, or six of those employees, be from one of the first or second category.
Okay.
So if you've been arrested, or if you come from a distressed area where you've lived the last 5 or 10 years and you're getting jobs here, then the employer, even though they're rich and they're paying you salaries, qualify for social equity. Okay. There are two lenses through that, and people immediately chose sides. Okay. One side was, this is nothing more than there's a prominent former retired politician who has sort of called this the slave owner clause of social equity ownership, where you're just essentially paying people to qualify for a benefit that you shouldn't have. There are other people on the other side who say, well, who are you to say that? I'm hiring people. It's my way or the highway, and the people who have the jobs like the jobs, and you shouldn't tell them they can't have the jobs and I can't have the benefits of getting them. But nobody really, you know, so that's what the conversation has been.
Mm-hmm.
You're either part of the problem or at least naive or whatever. But I have a couple of clients who happen to believe that there are many more people who will own equity in companies through working there than just through buying in or applying for a license.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of Microsoft and Amazon and, Google multimillionaires who, the only reason why they're millionaires is because they were relatively early employees at one of those companies.
Yeah. I feel that's going to happen here too. I feel that people that are starting out in the business, and if they're in different states have different clauses too, but I know that there's a state up this way that you could be an out of state owner, but there has to be someone in order to be a license holder in this state, in the state of Maine, you have to have someone that actually lives in the state of Maine. So now say you hire a head cultivator, you're giving them, I don't know what the percentage of ownership is, but you have to give them a percentage of the company because they have to be an owner. You know, you can't, they're not giving them to out of state, multi-state operators. So the people that work there have to have equity in the business, which I think in turn makes them want the business to succeed even more. So, and it's a good effect in certain aspects that the person.
I'll give you one better. I have a lobbying client who, as part of his craft grow application, committed to 20% company employee ownership.
Okay. And what is that defined for?
Well, again, 20% of whatever the company is worth will be owned by vested employees who get X amount per year.
They get certain percentages. Is it ramp up? So, a person.
Yeah. Well,
a ramp up period.
Yeah. And what I like is actually, the percentage being based not necessarily on the sort of beginning salary, because not everybody's going to get paid $1 million
right away,
but also being based on the length of tenure.
Yeah. Right?
So the more you hang around, the more ownership you get.
And that's reasonable too. So if you're there for a long time and it always starts with, like people talk about that, you got to start somewhere. So if you're starting there and you're sweeping the floors, and then you work your way up, and then you've been there for years and you've got you're vested. I mean, you're working your tail off for it.
So the point is I guess, how many people in minority communities are going to own, even if they own every license?
Yeah.
That's how many people. But if you actually demand that whoever owns the license actually give 20% of the company to their employees.
Interesting.
You're going to get a lot, many, many more rich people and minority communities, many of whom who could never get a fair shake in the first place because they couldn't get a job because of a conviction.
Yep.
Okay. So all of a sudden you're making people who are reentering from perhaps custodial placement and reentering society, you are essentially able to put them into a steady salaried full-time job that has benefits, 401k, 80% insurance, and gives you ownership. And that's so whether awesome. You are, you know, sort of doing a slave thing, or you are, you know, sort of doing the Lord's work, you know, nobody, I think that just so not like reality. And the reality is what piece is theirs?
Yeah.
That's, you know, because we all talk about social equity. What I find fascinating, I'm involved in a conversation with some folks at the University of Chicago, and they're, you know, these are some of the most brilliant economic minds in the country. And we all agreed that there is no definition of social equity. There's no quantification. Give me a checklist to evaluate whether this is a equitable program or it's not. And again, you know, if you have 75 dispensary licenses or 150 dispensary licenses, and you give them all to minority communities, you're still just going to have, you know, let's say 500 rich people.
Yep. Yeah, you're going to have people that are ponying up, that are ready to go.
You're not going to have 5,000 or 50,000 or 500,000.
Yep.
People who own a piece of Google or a piece of, you know, like for me, I miss those. I was too young to have had capital I could throw into Google before it was a thing. So I'm making up for lost time now. And I think that there are people who have never owned stocks or equity who can get jobs, who can really benefit and create generational wealth, leave their kids hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, what is their legacy? What are you leaving behind for your family? It's agreed.
Yeah. So it's so easy to point fingers and to sort of pick sides. And, it's much harder to actually give somebody a straightforward definition of what it is that you want in a quantifiable way that defines it as a benefit for a population rather than a group of owners.
It leads me like something too, like I've written down something before and I was thinking of the question, you know, like, well, we're talking about licensing and like, what are their challenges and different stuff. And like, one of them was, I had wrote a question down that says, you know, what should new license holders expect? You know, like, I was thinking of the challenge side of it, but like almost like what you're saying, what are the benefit side of it? You know, aside from, there's gonna be a lot of stuff going into it. So when you're going in and if you're gonna be from ground up, helping paint walls and build walls, that's almost like what do you expect? Meaning it could actually be on the positive side of it too. Listen, if I put in my time and effort, I'm actually going to get part of this company, which is that couldn't be any better silver lining, you know, green lining.
As a professional, a consultant, and an investor, I'm involved in several deals where what I'm providing is sweat equity.
Yep. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Why shouldn't that be okay for people who don't have all the stuff that I have?
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. Point is that sweat equity is a perfectly fine way to gain ownership as long as it's not usurious, okay? You're not working for free. You have a great, stable, well-paying job with 80% health insurance, 401k, path to ownership, and a mentorship, education, and advancement program to where you're not stuck watering the plants for the next 6 years.
Yeah,
I think if you could demand that of the entrance into the market, you could begin to sort of have an impact on actually populations.
I agree. Well, it's funny because people ask me too. I have friends that, you know, they're just, I want to get into the cannabis industry. I'm like, what aspect do you want to get into? Like, well, I've always grown. That's great. But you're not going to go into a commercial scale or even a craft scale cultivation. You're not going in as the head grower, man. You got to go in there as the guy that's watering, but know that, hey, listen, I've got a passion. And it's, yes, there's obviously the financial benefit of it, but also too, the passion is you're growing and learning that you can actually take all this knowledge. Just like you're an apprentice. If you go in there and start early, you're the apprentice. You could be the next guy that, or girl, and that would be petitioning or lobbying for a license. I mean, it just, it's so cool. Like I tell people, I'm like, just if you want to go, go start. Everyone's hiring. Everyone needs help. They're all busy. I mean, we see it. They are all busy. There's always something to do. If you want to work, you can go find it. I mean, if you want to learn how to get into the industry, go work for someone.
Right. And, you know, and I'm completely fine because, again, from a personal perspective, I don't really apply for licenses because that would be competing against my clients.
Yeah.
That I help apply for licenses. And so for me, I don't have a personal stake in it because, you know, I'm not in the game of trying to win these licenses on my own behalf. So
agreed.
They're not competing against me. And but what I do think is that, again, it's naive to think that ownership, that applying or buying into the license is the only path to ownership that will enrich entire communities. And I think assuming just because people of color get these licenses that they're going to benefit their own communities is not necessarily as simple as it seems. I think the more you spread the wealth and the more you require fairness in the industry through regulations and clarity and specificity and enforceability, the more you're going to come to real equity rather than just yelling and screaming at each other about who deserves it more.
Yeah, I mean, you got to get out there and do it a little bit. You know, like you say, it needs to be done. I mean,
yeah, and again, this is to say that I completely believe that there are populations in this country that are absolutely owed. And what I want to do is figure out a way of delivering on that in a practical, equitable way.
And this is a great industry, being that with all the knowledge that has been developed over the years, and this is almost a great way to, as an industry, to give back to the communities. I mean, you know, and how, if it can be established right, like you say, it could change. It can make some big changes.
Right. And you know what, ultimately I'll also admit and acknowledge that I am just one very, very, very unimportant stakeholder in this very, very, very important discussion that is life-changing for entire communities. And so I think you and I will both agree to, you know, give our advice when asked outside of, you know, BSing on a podcast.
Of course.
But I do think that, you know, there are solutions, and generally speaking, my job as a lobbyist and consultant is to help navigate a middle path.
Yep. Well, and like you said, though, too, like we give out plenty, like there's people always looking for information. Most people will take it. And we're always trying to kind of like you say, we're almost coaching and consulting. I don't want to say it's a consultative sale, but like when we talk to folks, we're trying to give them like a full solution, like a total growth solution. This is, you know, are you having challenges with this? Let me see if I can put you in touch with that person. So we're kind of trying to help them. You know, aside from the lighting and the monitoring and all these awesome things that we do, but we're trying to help them, because if the industry succeeds, like I keep on calling it too, with our ownership, it's like an annuity, because if we can get them going, get them growing, and they start somewhere, they're gonna expand. They're gonna keep on expanding. They're gonna, because the dollars to just build is so, it's just giant. And, you know, not to scare anyone away, but I mean, there's a pretty big cost to associated with starting up. But once they get going and they start harvesting and they start selling, and all of a sudden it's that repeat business. If we did them right, maybe they'll come back to us, you know, which it's been working so far. I mean, our repeat business and our referral has been huge. So, but yeah, it's,
right. I don't even have a website. I mean, my only way of connecting with potential customers is by introductions from other clients.
See, this is
right. And you know, so you really feel like you have a stake in the ecosystem.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and so I think that people entering this industry, I mean, look at what you and I have been talking about. What an amazing degree of complexity.
Oh, totally right? is.
And all the things to think about. But, you know, it's like, heck, at the same time, if you didn't think about zoning 2 years ago, you don't have anything now.
No, and it is it's a moving target, and there's regulations that keep changing, and they will, you know, because, you know, with environment, with carbon footprint, with all these different things that are important to, you know, and everybody's trying to do the right thing, because at some point there's going to be some shift in how we're powering these facilities. There already has been. They're already talking about it. So it's, you know, there's just so much to it.
Do you mind if I interview you for a sec?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because this is actually an issue for me, because I think, you know, nationwide, there's a growing acknowledgement that the security and other reasons for indoor cultivation are directly in conflict with, you know, energy conservation and perhaps other environmental considerations. And so across the country, how much are you seeing of the cannabis and hemp industries essentially over the coming years having to jump through more and more and more hoops in terms of the environmental impact? And where do you think we are on being able to have outdoor cultivation of you know, hemp's possible, but, you know, THC?
Well, there's a few questions there. There's a whole bunch of different points. I mean, to answer one of them with growing, like, I mean, I don't want to go backwards, but so growing outdoors, I can see that happening, but your return. So like your harvest is such a short time period, just like anywhere. Like if you're going to even grow outdoor vegetables in the Northeast, you're faced with challenges. So you're going to have either a blend or a mix of styles of growing. I mean, you can still do the totally closed, indoor controlled agriculture. So, I definitely see that as being a way, but what's happening is I'm seeing up here is like reducing that, you know, they're changing like the guidelines. If you're X amount of square feet, if you're a craft cannabis and you're 5,000 square feet, you can have X amount of wattage per square foot. Once you go above and beyond that, now you have to have a reduction. So if someone wants to expand, now the new expansion, they have to start making accommodations for, we have to use less power. And then that ties into, you know, the old school lighting, like people that have just grown because it's what they do and no one likes change. But once they start to see results, they're like, okay, maybe this isn't a bad thing. You know, like the old HPS and the CMH lights, those are like your street light. They just gobble up electricity, where when you go to an LED, you can actually get equal light and use less power because LEDs are so much stronger. So now we're just with our system, I already know that we're going to save them money because we can give them the same, they call it PAR, PPFD, the light that's hitting the plant. We can do it at, you know, 25 to 35% reduction in power. We already know that going in. So when you look at these bigger facilities that are starting to convert over or regulations have changed, and now they have to start doing it. They say, you know, you grandfathered in for this year or next year or for the next 5 years, but you have to show that you are moving towards that end result. And I was just with someone yesterday that was talking about that. So we're having dialogue with them because now they need to start changing over. And as long as they're phasing over, the Cannabis Control Commission is not going to bother them. You know, we're going to do one room every 3 months because there's obviously a giant capital investment.
Yeah.
But they're going to, obviously they know it takes time. I mean, no one's going to stroke checks for, I mean, maybe they will, maybe big dollars, but I mean, we hope, selfishly we hope, no. But you know, like, we understand that it's going to take time for them to do the conversion and convert over. And then their return on investment is just giant too. I mean, their return on investment is that now they're saving power. They're saving the environment because they're using less electricity. And then, you know, there's all these different things that, you know, they start to fall into place that, you know, just with like the carbon footprint and stuff.
And that's not to mention sort of the branding and marketing of your green instincts.
Yeah.
That
I mean,
contribute to your overall brand image.
And when we do, and we tell them about that, and, you know, and some people right now, they want to get going. So they are concerned, but they're not. But there's actually some folks right here locally in New England that are, they have solar panels all over the roof and property. They've got acres of the stuff, and they're trying to they're running the facility there. You know, I'm sure there's not really a surplus of it because the facilities do take, you know, quite a big demand on the grid. But if they're able to almost self-sustain it without hardly using any electricity off the grid, it's giant. I mean, you're setting the pace. And then too, like, there's the greenhouse style grows that we do see a lot of the greenhouses going up, but there's challenges in different regions. You know, you're with all the humidity and there's a lot of moisture mitigation that they're going to have some challenges. You know, a greenhouse in California, Arizona is a totally different animal than it is in the north, like in Michigan, in Illinois, in New England. I mean, they work, you can capture the sunlight, but there's certain times of the year that it's only light out for 6 or 8 hours. I mean, at the top, I mean, in knowing the plant, it takes a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. And to that point, I guess one of the things that, you know, I've been dealing with a lot lately is sort of conversation of how, at what point people have to start thinking about construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's...
excuse me again.
No worries.
Some people build a building and then they figure out how to adjust it for cannabis security.
Yeah. They need to start. Yes. And there's a lot of incentives here, especially, I mean, sure, you probably have it too. There's a lot of old mill buildings. And it seems like those regions or district, they have the power. And now people are going in there, or the towns or the communities are trying to bring back some industry back to them because they're just these empty mill buildings. But they have to go in there and, you know, they're opening up a whole book of, it's nothing wrong with it, but there's just going to be some challenges. I mean, we don't know what was being processed in that building, what chemicals are on the floor that are seeped into everything there. I mean, we just don't know. So, I mean, they have to go into that with that open head of, and now too, a lot of these older mill buildings, if they're doing processing and have facilities on each floor, now they got to put elevators in. We just have just with someone that they, if you have more than X amount of people per that town or per that state on each floor working, now you need an elevator. So people that are going into these mill buildings, I love it, but in the same breath, you don't know what was going on in there. So you have to be prepared.
So it seems like every cannabis license is a universe unto itself.
It really is. I mean, I feel that way. I mean, there's no, as I said earlier, we're kind of writing the rules as we're moving forward here. I mean, we're writing the book because there is books on how to grow and how to grow in each different facility. But if I have a certain strain and you have a certain strain and we could be on the same road, there could just be one little thing that's off or something that might be doing different, and it's grow differently. You can have different end results. So it's, yes, it's agriculture, but it's a finicky one too. I mean, it can be challenging.
Well, I have this fault of my own, which is sort of an inclination to at least slightly deviate from the recipe. And I like to cook and find that it's okay for me to switch things up a little bit.
For sure.
It's not when you're growing.
No, it's a science.
You got to stick like so close to the recipe that every micromillimeter and, you know, millionth of an ounce is correct. And so, you know, admittedly, I'll never be growing. I mean, I can grow, you know, Christmas cactus in my window, but, you know, that's the thing that I don't think I ever realized is the degree to which this is like rocket science. You know what I mean? Like even what you do, it's kind of rocket science.
It really is. I mean, I talk with Mikhail and Gary about our founders and we chuckle about how analytical growers are in good and bad. You know, okay, so these guys, you know, they've been growing, you know, we'll say a lot of them started off on a different market and now they're into legalized cannabis, but they are so understanding of like, they are just the numbers like that they rattle through their head. And then like, you talk to someone like, oh yeah, you guys are growing weed, smoke always high. I'm like, oh, maybe, but they are smarter than most. I might even say all cannabis cultivators, the guys that are in it, you know, they're in it for the ladies, you know, and it's just amazing that the numbers that are rattling through their head, you know, and they already know their ounces, grams, what they're getting, how, what their time, if they shave, like these guys are telling me, okay, so if, you know, my plant's actually going really well, if I cut, you know, half hour, 15 minutes off their light cycle, I'm not hurting this, but I'll save X amount of power over this cycle. And like, they've already done the math where they that didn't affect what their yield was, but they saved $5,000.
So, I find that just a note, I find this to be the case, by the way, with folks who have, were the traditional corner store providers of the product. Man, can folks like that do math in their head?
They just rattle it off.
And so when you criminalize that intelligence, how much sort of creativity and possibility and opportunity take off the table? So it's sort of like, you know, the amount of sense of running, being in this industry is no different than, you know, pharmaceuticals.
No. I mean, it just, yes. I mean, they're just, it's just a cool industry. I mean, I enjoy it, but I'm just looking at the time. I'm like, wow, we've actually been chatting here for a while. But I mean, Mark, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been great. And I would love to have you back on. We could chat a long ways here with a lot of our, just the knowledge and just, I love sharing and love helping people out in the marketplace. That's why we kind of set up this platform. And I look forward to talking with you again. Just want to thank everyone for listening to our podcast. Again, this is Mark Pesakovich. I said it right, from Illinois, and he's our good friend and he does lobbying. And if you need something or you want to reach out, we're going to put some info below at the podcast. So you can actually click on a link and maybe it'll drive him to his either his LinkedIn page or and reach out to him. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Mark, for listening in. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark. But this has been great. Thanks very much for the dialogue. This is awesome. I look forward to working with you some in the future.
Enjoyed meeting you. Stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, my friend. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. All
right, bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Grow Sessions. This podcast is brought to you by TSR Grow. I hope you learned something today. To learn more about Mark Pesakovich, please check out his bio below. If you have any questions you'd like answered, please feel free to reach out to us through our social media channels or via our website, www.tsrgrow.com. Please don't forget to share this podcast and remember, keep cultivating.